I'm Dr. Kirsten Patrick, Deputy Editor for the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Today we present to you something a bit different. We have two sets of conversations about partnering with patients in health research. Patient-oriented research is growing, but the practical day-to-day operations of involving patients and their caregivers in the design of research are still quite new. There are many lessons to be learned and tips to be shared. In the first conversation, we hear from a research group studying youth access to mental health and addiction services. Johanna Henderson is principal investigator of the project, and as you'll hear, she has a frank conversation with Jacqueline Relihan, one of the youth involved in the research study. Jacqueline shares how youth like her got to be involved and how they helped shape the study into one that measures outcomes that are important to them. The second conversation is about a research project that looked at ways to improve access to essential medicines for patients who have socioeconomic barriers to medicine access. Dr. Navindra Persaud, physician and researcher, chats with Diane Charter, a patient partner who was recruited in a unique way and ended up having a lot of input into their study. They discuss what worked well and areas that are in need of improvement. This podcast adds to a comprehensive supplement on patient-oriented research published in CMAJ. The supplement features 17 innovative health research projects. It is brought to you by the Ontario Spore Support Unit, or OSU, the group responsible for strategic initiatives and patient partnerships in research in Ontario. The OSU group is funded by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. These conversations offer a unique view into how researchers are involving patients as partners in health research, and thereby studying what matters to patients. We hope you will learn something from listening to them.
I'm Dr. Joanna Henderson, Senior Scientist and Director of the Margaret and Wallace McCain Center for Child, Youth, and Family Mental Health at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, and one of the principal investigators of a really exciting project called YouthCan Impact. And here with me today is...
I'm Jackie Relihan. I am a youth engagement facilitator here at CAMH.
So today we're going to talk a little bit about the YouthCan Impact study. This is a really important project that was launched together with youth and families and service providers, academics, and hospital-based clinicians to address gaps in the youth mental health system. We designed this, not only this project, which is a pragmatic randomized control trial, but also the actual intervention itself in very close collaboration with youth who had lived experience of mental health, substance use, or mental health and substance use service delivery. The project aims to allow us to gain a better understanding of how a hub-based model of service delivery, so that is service delivery in the community with walk-in access where a wide variety of services are available in one location, compares in terms of outcomes, cost-effectiveness, and perceptions of care as compared to treatment as usual in hospital-based adolescent psychiatry units. This project has been a long time in the making and has really allowed us to get an in-depth look at how engaging with young people with lived experience can bring a lot of benefits to a project. So Jackie, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to be involved with the YouthCan Impact Project?
Way back in the day, I was getting treatment at a hub that was very similar to what the project is. And I started volunteering with them after treatment. And then one day I got a message from the person who I was like, most connected with. And he said, "Hey, you should apply for this job. You'd be really good at it." And I was like, "Okay, sure, whatever, I guess, why not?" So I did, and now I'm here.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So Jackie, I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about how youth have been involved in the YouthCan Impact Project.
So you have been involved from the very beginning, from everything from like applying for funding and all that kind of fun stuff to stuff like our youth advisory group, which is a group of 10 to 15 youth who advise on the project from everything from website look and feel, stuff that we want to host on the website, to looking at some of the like measures that we're looking at. So we're looking more for functioning more than symptoms, because that's really what the youth wanted and what the youth found to be more helpful.
How has the team worked together? So are youth involved sort of on an ongoing basis or on a one-time basis? How has it actually worked?
So we involve the youth on an ongoing basis. We meet about every 6 weeks to a month, depending on what we have going. We bring them questions that arise from the different like research groups here at the hospital. Anything that can come up from like the frequency of how often we should offer DBT to what snacks need to be around, which is very important. So just that kind of stuff, literally anything goes to us, and we have quite a say. We've stirred the pot a few times and made everybody go back to the drawing board a few times. But yeah, they're super involved, and you guys really listen to what we have to say when we say, like, no, stop that. Bring it back.
Right.
You do. And it's really good. It helps. And it, everybody feels super valued on the group, which is even better.
And certainly from where I sit as one of the PIs on the project, the engagement with youth has been, it's been a big learning opportunity, I think, for the researchers on the team. But it's also been a really rewarding experience, because it's really easy to lose sight as a researcher what the final goal is in terms of, in this case, changing our service delivery to young people around youth mental health. And so having young people who have that experience, who feel comfortable speaking up and saying, no, it's not actually like that. It's actually like this. Or, but what about this other thing, has made a really important contribution. In terms of how you see the project having been enhanced or made better by the involvement of youth, what comes to mind for you?
So I've been here about 2.5 years, so I've really seen the project kind of go from no participants to what we're at now. So it's just having all the like feedback, just knowing that the youth voice is actually being heard makes it like really easy, because a lot of times like people will say like, oh, there was youth engagement involved. It's like, they had like one youth can't speak for all youth. Everyone's journey through the mental health system is different. You need to have all these different unique perspectives.
Now, in the Youth Can Impact project, youth team have made tons of contributions, like everything ranging from the design of the hub model of service delivery, to choosing the primary outcome, to selecting the measures that are used as part of the project, creating posters about the values that clinicians in the hub should follow and the values that researchers should follow. One of the things I think is most interesting is around space, the actual space that hubs are in. And in sort of the research literature, there's a lot of reference to youth-friendly spaces. I'm wondering, you know, what does that mean to you? And what kinds of things did the youth team do in terms of working with our community partners to create youth-friendly spaces?
I always say, if you're going to be working with youth, you need to have condoms and candy around, because, you know, we're youth. But it's just a super subtle way to kind of say, like, this is a space. There's no judgment. Whatever you need. Another thing that's really good to have around is just, like, charging cables, again. Super easy. oftentimes you get youth coming from like after school and, you know, they've been out all day. Their phone's like almost dead. Are they going to be able to make it home without it dying? Like, that's really anxiety inducing sometimes.
When I think about like traditional clinical spaces, I think of like something that looks like, you know, it's very clinical, it looks like doctor's offices. It's usually painted gray or white, and it's just like a series of offices. When, you know, when you think about what you want youth spaces to look like, or what we've done with our youth hub spaces, what are the kinds of things, you know, features you would look for, or ideas that the youth team have brought to those spaces?
Bright colors, lots of natural lighting, or like adjustable lighting. Being able to quickly change that is awesome. Having comfy furniture that youth are going to actually want to sit on and not just be super uncomfortable. Having staff that actually know how to like talk to youth and hold a conversation with youth is super important. Hiring the right people, on that note. If you are hiring people who are supposed to work with youth and they don't even like youth, like, what are you doing? There's a huge problem there.
And I think from my perspective, one of the things that's been really interesting is when we talk about co-creation and full engagement, that means we do a lot of things together that me as a researcher haven't necessarily done in the past. Like, I think about going to a conference and co-presenting at an academic conference. What do you think of that? Like, I feel like I've learned a lot in terms of even being able to communicate what are the key messages that we want to communicate when I hear you talk about, you know, different activities we've done. I'm wondering, you know, what's that been like for you as well?
I think, again, like validating that the youth voice is important and we're kind of just spreading this like youth propaganda. Please put chargers in the waiting room. Like, we need those. Just even like little dumb stuff like that. And like, your values are going to be totally different from my values. And like, you're coming from a totally different perspective than mine with lived experience. I think it really shows researchers that this is a super obtainable thing to do. You just need youth who care. And unfortunately, the system made a lot of youth who were let down, so they care about making it better.
So I guess I would say from my perspective, even though there have been tremendous benefits from where I sit, and I think what you're saying is from where you sit, it's been really positive, but there also have been some challenges. I wonder if you want to say something about any of the challenges.
I think some of the challenges are just like this whole research world is so hard to really grasp if you're not in university. Like, I have an art degree from college. So everything was kind of like, oh, like learning all these terms and then kind of like translating it to the other youth to be like, okay, so like, this is what this will actually mean. This is how it looks in practice. How do we take that information and make it relevant for the youth? So kind of like a little bit of like knowledge translation, that kind of stuff. We realized that youth didn't actually know what it meant to be a part of a research study as a participant. So we started making a resource for the youth, and for researchers to kind of be like, these are some questions that you're probably going to get asked. You should have these answered and ready to go. And we kind of, we ranked them and we made sure like the most important ones were listed first so you couldn't ignore them, that kind of stuff. And just using language that's actually like accessible to youth is super important, that kind of stuff.
Right, and that makes me think of one of the things that certainly the team has talked a lot is the role of youth with lived experience in training our staff. So training the research assistants who are going to be engaging with youth who are participants in the research project, making sure that they're approaching that, thinking first about the youth's needs and the youth's experience and creating a youth-friendly experience for youth, which I feel like we would have thought we were already doing. And it wasn't until we actually engaged youth with lived experience in that conversation that we saw different ways of actually doing that work. I'm wondering, do you have any do's and don'ts for researchers around how to do youth engagement?
I think I touched on one earlier, which was have a diverse group of youth, but like, don't be tokenistic about it. You can't just be like, oh yes, we have the token like person of color to just like get that one checked off. You have to have all kinds of different youth from all kinds of different backgrounds, because we're all going to have different experiences, and there's nothing wrong with having tons of youth involved. Even just like the way that you're going to engage different youth is going to be different. Like, I have some youth who I can only really engage with on our like hidden Facebook working group because they live on the other end of the city and there's no way they can make the meetings. So we do a lot of communicating online with them versus like our in-person meetings. So flexibility would be another one. And just recognize that even though their story might be different than yours, it's still valid.
Any things we should, as researchers, avoid when we engage with youth?
I think one of the biggest things to do would be to, like, again, like, don't be tokenistic, and to just appreciate everything that these people are giving to you. Their time, you know, honoraria is super important. Bus tokens are super important.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting that you raised those, because I think from my perspective, there's some do's and don'ts for researchers as well. And certainly, avoiding being tokenistic is definitely something that's, I think, critical for researchers. But also what I hear you saying around like communication, and valuing everyone's contributions. I mean, I think those are really good principles, but become especially important when we're bringing in people with lived experience to be part of our research team, really making sure we're transparent about what are the goals of that, whose goals are they, how do we make sure everyone experiences benefit from engaging in that work together, and that everyone's contributions are valued in ways that are meaningful for the people involved, whether that's community members or people with lived experience or people who are sitting in different kinds of research contexts where different kinds of outputs are valued. Anything else you want to share about Youth Can Impact and youth engagement in it?
I think this project has been really effective at making sure the youth are heard. And that in itself is like a huge win. I think now that we ironed out some of the kinks, because you know, every product's going to be different, I think now we kind of know how to kind of tie youth into all projects. And it's kind of spun into more and more engagement from more and more youth, because maybe this project just doesn't appeal, but maybe another project might be more appealing to them, so it might be a better fit for them to bring their expertise to.
You know, the message from my perspective as a researcher is really around, you know, engaging youth with lived experience in co-design of a research project can seem pretty daunting. And I think researchers might, you know, really see it as a challenge to the feasibility of the project. And I think, you know, there definitely are shifts that need to happen to make it possible, but the rewards have absolutely outweighed those challenges. And, you know, I guess my thoughts for researchers who are thinking about engaging youth in their research projects, not just in the sense of as participants, but actually as part of the research team, that with a certain amount of planning and a certain amount of thoughtfulness, your project will definitely be enriched by engaging youth with lived experience. Great. Well, thank you very much, Jackie, for being here today and talking with me about the Youth Can Impact trial.
It's no worries. I always enjoy chatting about an awesome project like this.
That was researcher Johanna Henderson talking with youth partner Jacqueline Relihan about their research study, Youth Can Impact. Next, we hear from Dr. Nav Prasad and patient partner Diane Charter, who chat about their study called Clean Meds.
So I'm Nav Prasad, a family physician and researcher at St. Michael's Hospital and the University of Toronto. I'm pleased to be here today with Diane, a member of the Community Guidance Panel for the Clean Meds Research Project. Diane, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became involved in the project?
Okay, well, I got involved in the project as part of a senior group out canvassing in the Church Wellesley area, which is the gay community in Toronto. And I was a member of the Senior Pride Network and have been doing a lot of advocacy work for senior LGBT members of the community. And since you were looking for diversity, I just thought that I would be a good addition to the panel. So I got the information that I needed and joined the panel and got involved.
Well, we're so glad that you did decide to become involved. The Clean Meds study is a randomized control trial of providing people who report not being able to afford medicines with free and convenient access, and then measuring the effect on medication adherence, appropriate prescribing, and surrogate health outcomes. Why do you think this is an important issue and an important project?
Just as part of the LGBT community, as a senior person, I have a background in healthcare, and I've seen firsthand how difficult it is for people when they're trying to prioritize life's needs. Housing, having a roof over their head, medical care, food, all of those things. And very often, I think medication is the one thing that if they have prescriptions, this will have to wait. And it gets put aside. And I felt very strongly that this project was very needed and a very good one. Now, with the recruitment strategy, too, because St. Michael's was going to be one of the sites where we were meeting and where things were taking off. So it was the recruitment was done around the neighborhoods that were close to St. Mike's. The downtown Toronto is so diverse in neighborhoods and everything. Did you get everything pretty much that you wanted?
I think we were really happy with the way the canvassing worked. So we created T-shirts that said free medicines, ? On them. And all of the team members who were involved in the canvassing wore those T-shirts. And then we also had postcards that briefly mentioned the issue that we were addressing, poor medication access, and indicated that we were planning to do a research study and asked for people who are interested to either give us a call or send us an email. And we walked through different neighborhoods, as you mentioned. We walked around the neighborhoods surrounding the hospital. We went to City Hall. We went down Bay Street through the financial district and ended up near St. Lawrence Market. So I think it was a cross-section of the city. The project takes place both in Toronto and in several rural communities in Manitoulin Island and Blind River, Ontario. And so our community guidance panel provides input from an urban perspective. And I think in the future, we'd like to do more to engage in the rural communities. We did, in addition to the canvassing, which is very local, also attempt random digit dialing that we purchased from a telemarketing firm. A list of phone numbers, and one of our summer students had the task of calling people, and most of them hung up, and we actually were not successful with our random digit dialing. We did also somewhat successfully visit some existing community organizations to let them know about what we were doing, and they distributed postcards and allowed us to speak to their groups, and we did get some interest through that. We weren't sure what would happen that day when we put on t-shirts that said free medicines. Mm-hmm. There were a few people who said that's never going to work. People are going to think you're just trying to sell something, and no one's going to end up participating in a project. We were able to reach a large number of people, and we did have people come to the meetings after the canvassing, and that was by far the most successful method of recruiting people to our community guidance panel. And here you are years later, still involved.
Oh, yes. That it was an attention-getting thing, and I think a really creative way to recruit people.
Can you describe the process for how you're involved in the project and how you provide your input?
We've been involved in the project, I think, at almost every step. And I think what's been good is there was a fear in the beginning on my part. I don't know about other members who volunteered. This would be a rubber stamp. This would be something nice. Yes, we're patient-centered and we've got patients involved. And it has turned out much to my great pleasure that we are making a contribution. We have been listened to. We've been part of the process, helping to shape the whole program. And that's been very gratifying, I think, to come away just knowing that you've been listened to and that you have been able to make a difference.
I can think of dozens of ways in which the Community Guidance Panel members, including you, have improved the project decisions that the panel has made that directly impacted the project. What are some of the decisions that stand out to you?
I think, one of the areas that was really interesting for me is when we asked the question at the meeting, what information, when the patients get their medications, what information should we give them about it? And with the diversity of members on the committee, everybody had a different take on it. I know you can really scare people when you give them too much information about side effects. If you don't give them enough information about how medications can react with what they're doing, that was a key. And we had some really in-depth discussion on that part.
The community guidance panel started before the project, and you provided input into things like what the intervention would be like. So that was an example you just gave, how the pharmacist would communicate with participants about the medications, and also what were the most important outcomes, and in fact, designed a list of questions that we're now in the process of asking each participant as they complete the follow-up periods. And Diane, you were also kind enough to participate in the selection of team members for the Clean Med study. So you helped us as we have been refreshing the research staff on the team.
Yeah.
And participated in the hiring process. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
That was a really interesting experience because the researchers, when candidates would come in, I had to listen to what were we looking for, what qualifications were sort of missing or what needed to enhance what everybody else was bringing to the table. And so just being part of those interviews, and I think actually when we did vote on which candidate we chose, it was unanimous.
Thanks for sharing all of those positive reflections. What were some of the challenges and things that you think could have been done differently?
Well, I think when we started off, we had a large panel, and that made it a little difficult because there were so many voices at the table. And for coming from so many, because of the diversity, coming from so many different directions, that I really thought at the beginning, we're never going to make any decisions. We're never going to get anywhere. And then gradually, as we got used to each other, and that took a few weeks, is for the group to gel. And some people left found it wasn't their cup of tea. And then the ones that stayed, I think it was a cohesive and a smaller group. And it really started to make progress. And I learned a great deal from the other points of view that were shared at the table. So that was good.
What about the food?
The food. Well, when we come to the meeting, it's around dinner time. So food is provided. I think that people were unhappy at the beginning because they were more fast food sandwiches and things like that, and people wanted a more healthy diet. And they did listen to the members, and we got much healthier food, so added to the feeling of virtue.
I think some of the panel members were surprised to attend a meeting in the hospital and be served food that they probably should not be eating for health reasons.
Yes. So what did you see as some of the challenges, some of the successes, and what would we not do again, and what would we do again?
Overall, it was exceeded expectations, the sort of input we got from the community guidance panel on both high-level issues, like whether or not we should extend the study from 1 to 2 years, and then really detailed issues like what the pharmacist should say to patients when he calls them, how many days after sending medications to patients should the pharmacist try to contact participants, and input in how we conducted the research, including hiring research staff. So we got, I think, much more input on a range of issues that we didn't necessarily expect to get, and the quality of the input was excellent. And I think we, over time, moved to making decisions during the meeting with the community guidance panel members, as opposed to getting input from the community guidance panel and then going off and making a decision by ourselves. Over time, I think we learned about the importance of reporting back to the community guidance panel on what we did after a discussion. And so we now make that the first item on the agenda, reporting back on what we've done since the last meeting to make it clear that the decisions that are made by the panel are meaningful, and reporting back increases our accountability to the panel, promotes transparency.
I think also the feedback really heightened the involvement for the panelists, and because it was like almost like a show. We could almost be in Blind River and talk to the pharmacist about these are some of the problems. And you can see some of the difficulties that we would never even imagine in the city. So that was a really exciting part of it, because it was coming from the actual person who'd experienced it.
I think also having the continued involvement of the community guidance panel members has been a tremendous vote of confidence in our project. I think as a researcher, when you're working on a project that takes years, you do sometimes ask yourself whether it is an important thing to work on, whether it's worth all of the time and effort. But having community guidance panel members who are willing to spend evenings with us in the beginning every month, and later on every 2 months or so, each meeting lasting an hour and a half, and we've now had more than 25 meetings. So that is very reassuring and comforting.
And actually, you've had to keep control of the meeting so that it ends on time, that we don't go over, because we can get into some quite animated discussions at them as well.
Yes, the input has been excellent. Sometimes there's more input than we can handle. And so, there were situations where we did have to curtail discussions, and we moved to, at the end of each discussion, making sure that we go around the table and give every one present the opportunity to express their view before we leave a topic. And that ensures that that there's no one individual or one perspective that dominates over others. Mm-hmm. Why do you think engaging patients and members of the public, community members in the research process is important? And why do you think this is the way of the future?
I think that people are becoming more knowledgeable and more sophisticated about their health care. And not everybody, but I think that a lot of people want to be partners in managing their health. I'm certainly one of those. The research is, you can get directly involved in helping to manage your health care, and there are so many avenues you're allowed to do that now. But the research is a whole different area, and that's a very exciting area to get involved in, because you're almost taking a step back from what it is to see how it got there.
Right.
So I definitely think it's the way of the future, and I think people are going to want to embrace it more and more.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for all your time in attending meetings, in helping us to share what we're doing, and for speaking with us today.
My pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed these conversations. You can find the whole supplement called Engaging Patients in Health Research, The Ontario Experience, on our website, cmaj.ca. It features 17 Ontario-based research projects that have involved patient partners in various ways. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, we encourage you to subscribe to CMAJ Podcasts on Apple Podcasts or your favorite app. While you're there, you can browse and listen to our many past episodes. And you can leave us a rating. I'm Dr. Kirsten Patrick, Deputy Editor for CMAJ. Thank you for listening.